Hello and welcome to Arts and Tech, brought to you by OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. I hope your day has gone well thus far. My name is Christopher Zhu, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading articles mostly from MIT's Technology Review, the blockchain edition, as well as, we'll start off with one video from one of my favorite YouTube channels called SciShow. This is a question that I always had a lot growing up, especially when I first got glasses when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And the title of the video is, Do Glasses Ruin Your Eyesight? And here are the very famous brothers, Hank Green, I believe. They write a lot of books on a lot of different topics. These happen to be the science-related ones. And yeah, we'll start off with this really interesting topic that I just ran across while going down the YouTube rabbit hole.
If you're a four eyes like me, you may have heard that wearing eyeglasses will ruin your eyesight. Over time, the thinking goes, the eye muscles that stretch the lens in your eyes aren't worked out as much, so they get weaker and you keep needing stronger and stronger prescriptions to see clearly. The idea that glasses hurt your vision is a super myth because that is not how glasses work. Most vision problems occur because the eyeball is either too long or too short, causing the cornea and lens to bend or refract the light either too far in front or behind the retina, giving you blurry vision. If your eyeball is too long and the light is focused in front of your retina, then you are nearsighted or myopic, and you can see things up close but struggle with things at a distance, like me. If it's too short and the light is focused behind your retina, you're farsighted and you can read that sign halfway down the street, but you have trouble reading what's right in front of you. Your eye muscles can bend the lens more or less to try and focus light onto the right place, but those muscles can only contract or relax so much to accommodate squat or oblong eyes. So weak eye muscles are not why you have bad eyesight. If that were the case, we would be doing eye exercises to cure our poor vision. Glasses do what properly shaped eyeballs do, which is make it possible to focus the light that's coming into your eye directly onto the retina, allowing you to see crisp images. The only effect they may have on your eye muscles is reducing excessive strain on them. There was a time, though, when doctors thought eyeglasses could do more. For decades, optometrists purposely prescribed glasses for nearsighted kids that didn't fully correct their vision because they thought it would help keep their eyesight from getting worse. That's because in children, the eye is still growing and usually gets longer as it grows in the skull. In kids who are nearsighted, this could make the myopia worse. And doctors thought that fully restoring distance vision would make kids' eyes grow even longer as they tried to compensate to see things up close through corrective lenses. So doctors under-prescribed, thinking that would keep eyes from elongating as much. But in 2002, a clinical trial called that into question. After 2 years, kids who were given weaker lenses actually ended up with worse vision. The results were so striking that the researchers had to stop the study early due to ethical concerns. Subsequent studies haven't always found such a strong negative effect of subpar glasses, but there's no evidence that under-correction helps, and optometrists have largely stopped the practice. So glasses won't ruin your vision. If anything, they may prevent it from getting worse. And of course, yes, you might need stronger prescriptions as time goes by, because as you age, the lenses in your eyes get stiffer, making it harder for them to change focus. But it is not your glasses' fault, so keep wearing them because they help you see stuff and also just look cool. Thanks to all of our patrons on Patreon.
Yeah, so that was always a misconception that I had when I was young, that I shouldn't wear my glasses because I get progressively blinder. But I think it makes sense, right? You should trust your optometrist or your ophthalmologist and go with whatever they prescribe you. And so that's always nice. I always like those ideas, like debunking myths. Maybe a lot of you guys already knew that, but I thought it was a nice reminder. And back to our regular scheduled programming. We're continuing on this idea of blockchain, except now we're spreading past the technical content of what makes up a blockchain, and now we're going towards more applications and specifically today, going on a global sort of mindset on how we can help people all over the world with this technology in ways that honestly were rather inconceivable maybe just a few months or even years ago. And so our feature article for today is titled The Place Where Life Hangs by a Chain, and it's specifically in reference to blockchains presence in Jordan and other refugee territories with a great population of refugees, and the header image is captioned: A customer pays for groceries at a supermarket in the Zaatari refugee camp, with a picture of a woman in a very bright pink headscarf, who's holding what looks like to be a security camera that's verifying the eye footprint, what do you call it? Like you see in those like spy movies, like eye index of a customer, I suppose, to confirm their identity when they pay for groceries. That's interesting. The subheading is, a sprawling refugee camp in Jordan is an early test of whether blockchains can reinvent the way we own, control, and administer our legal identities in the 21st century. Story and photographs by Rush Jaskalian. I have not seen this journalist write yet. Syrian refugees could regain legal identities that were lost when they fled their homes. A few times a month, Bassam pushes a shopping cart through the aisles of a grocery store stocked with bags of rice, a small selection of fresh vegetables, and other staples. Today, he's wearing a black sweater tucked into denim jeans, which are themselves tucked into calf-high boots caked in mud. The Tazweed supermarket, where he's shopping, is on the periphery of a 75,000-person refugee camp in the semi-arid Jordanian steppe, 6.5 miles from the Syrian border. At the checkout counter, a cashier tallies the total, but Bassam doesn't pay with cash or a credit card. Instead, he lifts his head to the black box and gazes into the mirror and camera at its center. A moment later, an image of Bassam's eye flashes on the cashier's screen. Bassam collects his receipt, which reads iPay and World Food Program Building Blocks across the top, and walks out into the noonday chaos of the Zaatari refugee camp. I suppose not dissimilar to those Amazon Go as you've seen, where you just walk into the store, pick whatever you want off the shelf, and as you walk out, it'll scan both, I believe, just your phone, not necessarily your eye, like in this case. It'll scan your phone and then automatically be able to tally up as you walk through the store which items you took off the shelf, and then subsequently charge those to your Amazon account and your credit card that's linked to that. Though Bassam may not know it, continuing on, his visit to the supermarket involves one of the first uses of blockchain for humanitarian aid. By letting a machine scan his iris, he confirmed his identity on a traditional UN database, queried a family account kept on a variant of the Ethereum blockchain by the World Food Program, or WFP, and settled his bill without opening his wallet at all. Started in early 2017, Building Blocks, as the program is known, helps the WFP distribute cash for food aid to over 100,000 Syrian refugees in Jordan. By the end of this year, the program will cover all 500,000 refugees in the country. If the project succeeds, it could eventually speed the adoption of blockchain technologies at sister UN agencies and beyond. Building Blocks was born of a need to save money at its core. The WFP helps feed 80 million people around the globe, but since 2009, the organization has shifted from delivering food to transferring money to people who need food. This approach could feed more people, improve local economies, and increase transparency, but also introduces a notable point of inefficiency, working with local or regional banks. For the WFP, which transferred over 1.3 billion US dollars in such benefits in 2017, about 30% of its total aid, transaction and other fees are money that could have gone to millions of meals. Early results of the blockchain program touted a 98% reduction in such fees. And if the man behind the project, WFP executive Homan Haddad, had his way, the blockchain-based program will do far more than just save money. It will attack a central problem in any humanitarian crisis. How do you get people without government identity, documents, or a bank account into a financial and legal system where those things are prerequisites to getting a job and living a secure life? Our first heading is owning your identity. Haddad imagines Bassam one day walking out of Zaatari with a so-called digital wallet filled with his camp transaction history, his government ID, and access to financial accounts, all linked through a blockchain-based identity system. With such a wallet, when Bassam left the camp, he could much more easily enter the world economy. He would have a place for an employer to deposit his pay, for a mainstream bank to see his credit history, and for a border or immigration agent to check his identity, which would be attested to by the UN, the Jordanian government, and possibly even his neighbors. Such a record, perhaps stored on a mobile phone, could let someone like Bassam take his data from Syria to Jordan and beyond, backed up online in encrypted form. Syrian refugees using such a system, and most in Zaatari already have smartphones, could regain legal identities that were lost along with their documents and assets when they had to flee their homes. In this scenario, Bassam could move to Germany or back to Syria and easily prove his educational credentials, demonstrate his relationship to his children, and get a loan to start a business. in most countries, this is a parenthetical, without an ID, you can't get a bank account, and thus without a bank account, you can't get a place to live or a legal job. If such a system had existed before Bassam left his hometown of Daraa, he might have avoided Zaatari altogether and become a productive member of Jordanian society straight away. Even if Syria revoked his passport, or if a school with a record of his degrees were bombed, an immutable register of his history could still smooth his entry into an adopted country. A number of organizations are already working on aspects of this idea. In Finland, a blockchain startup called Moni, M-O-N-I, all caps, has collaborated since 2015 with the Finnish Immigration Service, giving every refugee in the country a prepaid MasterCard backed by a digital identity number stored on a blockchain. Even without the passport necessary to open a Finnish bank account, a Moni money account lets refugees to get loans from people who know and trust them, helping them build rudimentary credit histories that can make it possible to get institutional loans down the road. Meanwhile, companies like Accenture and Microsoft are joining nonprofit organizations in a public-private alliance called ID 2020. The mission is to help achieve the UN goal of providing legal identity to everyone, starting with 1.1 billion people who lack any officially recognized proof of their existence. At the heart of such systems is a concept known as self-sovereign identity. It was popularized in 2016 by Christopher Allen, an American technologist, who outlined principles for a digital proof of existence owned by the individual. In such a scheme, identity would be portable and not dependent on any state or central authority, and the consensus is growing that a blockchain should be at its center. Blockchains, Allen told me, are critical to such identity systems because they solve previously, quote, unsolvable problems. By storing an encrypted identifier in a blockchain, one can separate the authentication system from one's data, helping to protect privacy. Blockchain systems are also more secure than conventional identity records because they cut out third-party intermediaries. They can be easier to use, they can survive disasters that might wipe out more centralized and record-keeping systems. The ultimate goal is a system in which a user owns and totally controls some kind of digital wallet, much like the physical one we carry today for our paper documents. The wallet stores claims made by the user, like name and date of birth, evidence for those claims, like copies of birth certificates or utility bills, and third-party validations, known as attestations, and further support an individual's claims, like a government confirmation of the details on a birth certificate. Such a wallet could reside in a smart chip on a key fob or something resembling a credit card, or it could be a secure enclave within one's phone, like those already provided by some manufacturers. With the right technology, says Haddad and others, a blockchain ID system could cover many more claims than the kind found on licenses or passports. Claims like over 21 or U.S. citizen. It might, for example, help a refugee prove his or her professional background or family connections. And a quick interruption, there's a lot of really amazing photos here. I believe this journalist is also a photojournalist. And the first one is a picture of Houman Haddad, who is the man featured in this article. He's the UN executive behind building blocks and its use at the Jordanian camp. The first photo is him staring to the camera with what looks like to be like a sunset type of lighting on his face. The second photo is a mural at the Zaatari camp, which looks like it's displaying three very young children that are crouching down and doing something that's not really identifiable. But the rest of the camp looks like they kind of look like remodeled shipping containers in some ways. It's very arid in this area. There are some telephone poles, though, and so that gives a sense of some development. But there are a massive amount of these small little refugee huts, almost, that are sprinkled on this photo. And the third one is Bassam, who is the refugee in question in this article. Bassam gets his eye scanned to pay at the market's checkout, and it is the same as the header photo at the very beginning of this article of the woman in the headscarf getting her grocery bill by scanning her eye into the system because she's registered, or he is registered, into their system. And the large two-page spread photo is captioned, "Zaatari is a bustling city that sprang into existence as a tidal bore of humanity crashed over the Syrian border in 2012. And it is a sprawling picture of this sort of shanty town almost. Everything is very level, perhaps all the buildings are no more than 10 feet, 8 feet high. Nearly 75,000 Syrians live in the sprawling camp, including many children and young adults. So if you think, you know, you wouldn't, I would never consider this a city, but there's so many homes in here. Wow. And our final three little spread of photos is, first up, at the Tazweed supermarket, top residents of the camp can buy goods using a blockchain-based account. And it's another one of those small squat buildings, except it has a lot of shopping carts in front of it, and as well as a World Food Program painting and mural on it. And so this is where they have implemented that eye scanning technology. An iris scan in the second photo is used to establish digital identity at the checkout. The system uses a traditional database and an account stored on a permission variant of the Ethereum blockchain. And a quick reminder, Ethereum is, yes, a cryptocurrency in some ways, but it's kind of like Bitcoin 2.0 in the sense that Bitcoin was geared just for money. And even in that sense, there were problems with that model, specifically for currency. But Ethereum essentially took it to another level in 2014, 5 years later after Bitcoin came out. And its whole point was to be able to democratize the technology of blockchain to not just currency and to get us away from fiat money, but to allow us to expand into healthcare, and in this case, into groceries. And so you can think of Ethereum as a sort of more multi-purpose blockchain, more than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is rather sequestered to currency, but it is the original, so it gets all that attention. And our third photo is the supermarket offers bulk supplies of necessities such as rice, oil, and sugar, and it shows this tent. Well, almost looks like a greenhouse tent, and it's stocked with what looks to be pallets of different goods, rice, oil, sugar, all things that you need. And now continuing on to the second part of our feature article, who controls it? And by it, this article is referring to, of course, the blockchain that they're suggesting essentially run the livelihoods of all these people in these refugee camps. It will take a while to achieve that grand vision. Haddad's idea for building blocks was to start by creating an account on a blockchain for every family of Syrian refugees in a Jordanian camp. Families then wouldn't have to wait days for local banks to transfer their money or have to share identifying information with the banks, or some unscrupulous employee might steal or misuse it. Oh wow, I can't believe that's a concern as well. Meanwhile, the WFP, instead of forwarding money before it's spent, could itself tally all refugee purchases and pay participating stores afterward in local currency. That's a big deal, since upwards of 30% of UN assistance is lost to corruption. Yeah, honestly, that's a huge problem, as well as with people wanting to donate, right? I think there is that perception that that not knowing where your aid is going makes you less likely to want to donate, right? Because it seems like a waste. And that's true, right? There's just the 30% of UN assistance is lost to corruption. In an early test of the building blocks payment idea in Pakistan, however, the transactions were slow and the fees were too high. Haddad decided one of the problems was that the system was built on the public Ethereum blockchain. The current version of building blocks, the one now used in Jordan, runs on a permission or private version of Ethereum. Clarification, on a public blockchain, anyone can join the network and validate transactions. Such a system makes it very difficult for any one person or agency to tamper with or force transactions, but transaction fees do tend to add up. On a permission blockchain, however, a central authority decides who can participate. The upside of the permission system is that Haddad and his team can process transactions faster and more cheaply. The downside is that the WFP has control over who joins its network, and it also has the power to rewrite transaction histories. Instead of cutting the banks out of the question, it has essentially become one. For Bassam and his fellow refugees in Zaatari, the distinction may not even matter. Bassam told me he'd bought groceries with an iris scan even before building blocks was implemented. But in that case, an actual bank had handled the transaction, and before that, he had a card the cashier would scan. But sometimes it wore out and it could take weeks to get replaced. The new system works better, he says. It's a major success, says Haddad, who explains that it reduces costs and the risks of sharing refugees' data while simultaneously improving the WFP's control, flexibility, and accountability. Now, if we get a call that 20,000 people are coming in the night, we can have everything ready for them in the morning. The old way would have taken 2 weeks and required paper vouchers. But because Building Blocks runs on a small permission blockchain, the project's scope and impact are narrow. so narrow that some critics say it's a gimmick, and the WFP could just as easily use a traditional database. Haddad acknowledges that, of course, we could do all of what we're doing today without using blockchain, he says, but he adds, my personal view is that the eventual end goal is digital ID, and beneficiaries must own and control their data. Other critics say blockchains are too new for humanitarian use. Plus, it's ethically risky to experiment with vulnerable populations, says Zara Rahman, a researcher based in Berlin at the Engine Room, a nonprofit group that supports social change organizations in using technology and data. After all, the bulk collection of identifying information and biometrics has historically been a disaster for people on the run. Think of the Holocaust or the more recent ethnic cleansing of Rohingya in Myanmar. A matter of courage. Ultimately, the question with building blocks or any similar system is whether it will put ownership of digital IDs in the hands of the people being represented or simply become an easier way for corporations and states to control people's digital existence. Bob Reed, CEO of a blockchain identity startup called Everid, told me he expects a battle over this question in the next few years. Either it goes to individuals or it goes to major institutions that will mine our data. Still, he says, the hope is that the discussion will move away from such either-or framing. The real promise of using blockchains will not be realized until organizations like the WFP and the UN have the courage to open at least parts of the system to other agencies and then take to the bravest step of all and turn over ownership of the data to beneficiaries like Bassam, who currently has little to say in the matter because he has to be in the system if he wants to even eat. Building blocks could, in theory, accomplish this if it evolves according to Haddad's vision. For instance, the WFP could offer its technology to others as a basic accounting system, tracking disbursements for food, and later adding entries for land ownership, educational credentials, and travel history. If outside nonprofit organizations were allowed to add nodes in the blockchain network, it could become more like a public blockchain, with its advantages of being harder to hack or cripple because it is decentralized and distributed. Walking around Zaatari, a bustling city that sprang into existence as a tidal bore of humanity, crashed over the Syrian border in 2012, shows what a severe test it will be for building blocks ambitions. Just beyond the two officially sanctioned grocery stores that accept payments using building blocks, there are scores of mom-and-pop vendors openly running what are essentially black market shops, selling everything from food to washing machines to old bikes. If building blocks can't be adopted there, then aside from making the WFP's operations a bit more efficient and transparent, it will remain little more than a centrally controlled database dressed in a costume of distributed, decentralized trust. Rusk Juskalian is a freelance writer based in Munich, Germany. He visited Zaatari this February. Can building blocks fulfill its real promise and be more than a centralized controlled database? Is a caption for our final photo, which is of a market that's very well stocked with produce. I see peppers, looks to be like zucchinis in some way, and those very large Asian eggplants. All the signs are written in Arabic, and this looks like a kind of warehouse situation with large stacks of grains and rice in the background, as well as what looks to be refrigerated compartments of milk and even eggs. Wow. It's amazing to see how different, I suppose, people live. How should I phrase it? I suppose it's interesting to see the disposition of everyone around the world and how, in some ways, we're perhaps even connected by blockchain and this crazy technology that's blowing up right now. Yet, we live such different lives. We also live such similar lives. We all go grocery store shopping, maybe in different ways, in different situations. Maybe our cities and towns and neighborhoods and homes look different. But in the end, there's still, like, technology still touches everybody. And I think that's why it's so inherently important. You know, it's the same thing as art. You know, art touches people in a lot of ways. I think technology does, too. And perhaps even to a greater extent, an even greater practical extent. And so our next quick little five-minute article is something really interesting. It's a lot of like flash little opinions, I suppose, from just different people who support blockchain. They come from all different backgrounds, and it's titled, What Makes Blockchain Devotees So Passionate About the Technology? Is it a means to get rich or something much bigger? And how do you even explain the thing to people who don't quite get it? We sent reporters to blockchain conferences in Dallas, Texas, and Cambridge, UK, to find out. Our first one, this by the way, is called The Blockchain Believers, by Amalia Illinger and Dan Solomon. Our first blockchain believer is Elizabeth Munker, age 28, from the United Kingdom. She says, we're going to start seeing the beginnings of a borderlessness in politics and the marketplace. That's what really stood out to me. To not be at the behest of people who are in control anymore. And that is the basic idea of blockchain decentralization, cutting out the middlemen. From Ari Lotfitper, age 33, in Dallas. We should stop trying to explain blockchain and start trying to show what the benefits are, because consumers don't really need to know how it works. They don't know how Visa or the Treasury, how any of those things work, but they know that they add value to their lives. Now, I should mention, these people all look very different. So our first woman, Elizabeth Munker, has lavender silver hair and is wearing a beanie and looks very much like the poster child of millennial aesthetics. Our second man is also a bit like that. He kind of looks like the Joker from Batman, a pink blazer, pink shirt, and like bright green pants with a white belt and what looks to be, I don't know if you've ever seen them, they're like shoes, but they have cutouts for the toes. They're like toe shoes. Yeah, and then, but our third man is a very normal looking, I suppose, compared to the other two, in traditional, in a more archaic sense, businessman, wearing glasses and sitting down. This is Chris Nichols, age 47, from Dallas. He says, the internet was really started because of the same ideas. We wanted the freedom to share information, freedom of voice, level the playing field, allow small ideas to become big. This is all the same thing that's going on. It's just another layer on top. Michael Mullen, in his 50s, also from Dallas. Years ago, when Bitcoin was 3 cents, I got too busy to buy it. And they kept saying, buy it. And I kept saying, I'll get to it. And then I forgot. And then the other week, I saw it was at $19,000. I thought if I had it, I'd sell it now, but I didn't have it. I really kicked myself in the butt. Those are millions of dollars that I could have had. And I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. Peter Jersic, age 23, from the UK, was asked, why do you tell your friends about cryptocurrencies? He says, they were like, you're putting all that money in? You're crazy. And now they're all calling me for advice. The reporter asks, has it made you rich? Oh, yes. In my country, Croatia, yes, I bought a house. Well, yeah, it really has changed some people's lives. Now, this is Justin Drake, age 29, from the UK. The internet unlocked applications we didn't think were possible, like Twitter, which came completely out of the blue. The same way the internet revolutionized communication, blockchain is going to revolutionize trust. Now there's an alternative to institutions and governments. We can now just rethink the whole thing. Next we have Henry Eines, age 43, from Dallas. He says, through the blockchain, everyone's going to have a global ID. So you have your own genome that'll be anonymized, encrypted, and then through crypto keys, you'll be able to totally manage who has access to your genome. You can then donate it. So you can donate it, you can monetize it, but this is all going to be something that you can control. Next, we have Amber D. Scott, age 39, from Dallas. What do you think this ends up doing 10 or 20 years down the line? She says, I think that if I had an answer to that, it would be the most faked answer that I've ever given anything to anything in my life. Okay. If you asked me in 1997 what the internet was for, I would tell you I could use it for email and to download some pictures of breasts. And now it's on my phone, and I can do so many ridiculous things with it at the touch of a button or swipe at any point in time. I don't think we know what those future iterations look like. I would love for people to have more financial sovereignty and more control. I would love for it to lead to a freer, more borderless, more censorship-resistant world. From Ashkay Shah, age 21, in the UK, in India, there's a lot of black market trading going on. It seems that with blockchain, with its ledger that can never be changed, it's a secure location. And as someone who's seen black market deals happening in front of my eyes, the idea that might become a lot harder to do and might one day be eradicated is just really fascinating. And finally, we have John Goldworth, age 89, from the UK. He was asked, would you buy any cryptocurrency? And he said, no, because I don't back horses. And you know if a horse doesn't win, you don't get anything. Same with a cryptocurrency. If it fails, you've got nothing. And that concludes our latest episode. I believe episode 4, yes. Episode 4 of Arts and Tech. As always, thank you so much for listening to today's Arts and Tech segment. If you want to hear about a certain topic more, or if you have any other questions or comments of the program, or any contentions with any of my ad-libbing or sidetracks, please give us a call at 210-829-4223. I hope you have a wonderful and safe day or night, whenever and wherever you may be listening to this program. Stay knowledgeable and stay curious. This program, of course, will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. My name is Christopher Zhu, signing off from Owl Radio. Until next time, thank you.